An extraordinary conversation about travel to the stars this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. My guests are UC Santa Barbara physicist Philip Lubin and his former intern-turned-partner Travis Brashears. You might think or might hope that a gully on Mars was carved the same way they get made here on Earth. Bill Nye says not so fast. And Bruce Batts takes us to Central Africa for the fascinating answer to the weekly space trivia contest. Let's get started with the Planetary Society's senior editor, Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, let's start with the hot one, and it's a hot photo.
That's right. We're talking about the hot planet Venus, of course, and an image from my blog that actually uses heat to see Venus's clouds. You're looking at an image of Venus that is shot at a wavelength of 2.25 microns. And at that temperature, Venus's lower atmosphere is blazing hot, radiating heat out into space, but some of that is blocked by these very turbulent looking clouds. It's a really unusual image of Venus, part of a set that Akatsuki took and posted on the occasion of its first anniversary in orbit, its first Venus anniversary, that is.
We'll skip the third rock from the sun and go on out to Mars and the surface of the red planet.
Yeah, fittingly for the summer, both rovers, Opportunity and Curiosity, are road tripping right now. Curiosity is put on about half a kilometer south from the last drill site, and during that time has traversed about 25 meters vertically, which means that it's about time to start drilling again. So look for Curiosity to stick another drill hole in a Martian rock sometime in the next month. Meanwhile, Opportunity has finished the initial look at the Marathon Valley and is now road tripping around to the north side of the valley.
I got to talk to John Cassani, a manager of the Mars Exploration Rover's Opportunity. He is such a proud guy, and he has every right. 12.5 years of that rover crawling across the surface.
And 43 kilometers now. The odometer just ticked over.
Absolutely incredible. All right, there's one more for us to talk about. That is out of Jupiter, where this is going to be a big month, but we still have to wait a little while.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to August 27th. It'll be the first time that Juno has swung close to Jupiter since orbit insertion. On the occasion of orbit insertion, they weren't allowed to have their science instruments on. So this will be the first time that they get to use these science instruments very close to Jupiter. And of course, in addition to science instruments, they also have the education and public outreach camera called JunoCam, which will give us our first amazing high-resolution polar views of Jupiter, as well as the closest ever images of Jupiter's cloud tops, if everything goes well. So keep your fingers crossed and stay tuned on August 27th.
This is just a taste of what you can find in Emily's What's Up in the Solar System August 2016 edition. She just posted it. It is at, of course, planetary.org. Just look for her blog. It's a July 29th entry, and we'll get us through an exciting month in the solar system. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
Our senior editor, she is the planetary evangelist and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Bill Nye is the CEO of the Planetary Society. Bill, I don't care. I want to believe that water is making gullies on Mars.
Well, man, I guess I do too, but you got to respect the facts. That's science. Yeah, I'm sorry, man, but these gullies, not the recurring slope lineae, everybody, not the RSLs, which were formed by water. These are other gullies that people presumed were formed in this, my understanding, presumed to be formed in the same way, or formed by something else. And I love the speculation. Blocks, chunks of frozen solid carbon dioxide, blocks of dry ice sliding down hills on Mars. I mean, it's crazy if that's how it went. And they determine this, we determine this by looking at the soil that is in these gullies. And you would expect to find clays, which are a result of water flowing, some alkaline materials, but we don't find that. And when I say we, and I say they, we're talking about instruments aboard satellites in orbit around another planet. It's just cool. You guys, when we show they're probably not water, they're probably not water.
We are learning so much about Mars. It may not always be what we'd like to learn or what we wish we could learn, but it's the truth of another world.
That's right.
That's right. And you got to, and I love it in the sense, Matt, that it's the process of science. When new information comes in, you revise your outlook, your knowledge about the other world, you change it. That is the wonderful nature of the of natural philosophy, the process of science. So it is exciting. Now, Matt, in other news that interests me particularly, Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency is fighting for funding for their X-ray observatory. They want to fly again. And they're converting what you would call a sounding rocket, a rocket made to explore the atmosphere, converting that to fly CubeSats. So the Japanese Aerospace JAXA is getting involved in CubeSats along with the rest of the world, which means there'll be a bigger market for it, which means the price will come down, which means more people will be engaged in the journey and the adventure of space exploration. I mentioned just this one story. It's just cool.
And the best of luck to JAXA as they try to remount that lost Hitomi X-ray telescope mission. And who knows, NASA may be helping out there as well. Bill, I love talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Carry on.
That's Bill Nye. He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, getting some well-earned R&R, but still checking in with us. Next up, a conversation with Phil Lubin, the guy who is getting ready, learning how to send small sails, laser-driven sails, to the stars. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a thrilling ride, beginning with a 30,000 G kick in the head. When we last talked with Philip Lubin and Travis Brashears, they were getting ready to make a presentation about using a giant laser array to defend our planet from near-Earth objects. Little did I know that their work was about to reach Warp 9, which is a mixed metaphor of sorts. Philip is a founding member of the Experimental Cosmology Group at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Travis Brashears just finished his first year as an undergraduate at UC Berkeley. But when we first met, he was still a high school student working with Philip. Now, these two pioneers are working together on a plan to send probes to Alpha Centauri and beyond. My fascinating conversation with Philip and Travis actually ran for more than an hour. You can hear it all on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio, where we've also got links to their research and much more. Philip, Travis, it is such a pleasure to get you back on the show. I don't know if you remember, it's not that long ago, it's only been a little bit more than a year, since we first met in a cafeteria in Italy at the Planetary Defense Conference, and that's where this started.
Yeah, I do actually do remember that. I believe I had lima beans, one of my great loves in life, in addition to steel-cut oats. Yes, I remember that very much.
You know, frighteningly, I think you're right. I think I do remember you having lima beans.
It's pretty bad. It's probably what extraterrestrials eat anyway. Yeah, a lot has happened since that time in, what was it, April of 2015?
Yes.
Okay, April 2015. Yeah, Travis and I were both at the Planetary Defense Conference, and it was a great pleasure to meet you. We had some wonderful conversations there, but you're right. An enormous amount has happened with our work, both technically, politically, and even economically. Yeah, I would not have imagined a year later, which probably just about 12 months later, that things would change so dramatically.
I would not have either, and I feel like I got in on the ground floor here. Travis, you have moved on. I hear you're now at UC Berkeley.
Yeah, I go to school at Berkeley and study engineering physics, and I'm also pre-business.
All right, good. You'll be an interstellar entrepreneur with that background.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be paving the new companies to the interstellar travel frontier.
Move over, Elon.
Yeah, watch out. Mars is not enough.
We got to get some background because not everybody's going to be familiar with this. Philip, give us the thumbnail description of what you have proposed for getting not humanity, but our presence out to the stars.
At the 2015 PDC conference, a Planetary Defense Conference, where we three of us were, our focus in the talks was on the uses of directed energy for defending the planet against asteroids, other things, comets included. But when we started this program in 2009, looking at scaling up of directed energy systems, initially for planetary defense, essentially from the very beginning, certainly within a few days of when I started working on this, I started writing down other applications of the same system. And one of those applications was achieving extraordinarily high speeds with spacecraft. Hence, that was sort of the genesis of this whole idea, which is, as you said, sort of taken off in the realm of, you know, we now have, looks like, a realistic approach to getting things to interstellar distances. And that was really came out of that work, essentially from the very, very beginning, just that we had to find some home for it. We proposed to NASA several times, and finally in 2015, they funded our Phase 1 NIAC program with the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts to explore the uses of directed energy combined with a wafer scale spacecraft to achieve relativistic speeds, which would then enable interstellar travel within a human lifetime in the sense that we would get to the target in significantly less than a human lifetime. And that was sort of our goal, is make it not 1,000-year missions, which, you know, people have talked about, you know, in terms of, you know, world ships where you send people, but we wanted to talk about what could be done today in reality, not with some hypothetical, you know, warp drive or wormhole or, you know, things that don't exist, but rather with things that do exist and being applied in, you know, intelligent ways while being hard is feasible. And so that's basically the combination. You use directed energy in the form of a laser array to use the momentum in the photons to push on a reflector, which then drives the spacecraft at incredibly high speeds. And we don't have the same kind of problems that you have in ordinary rockets, where you carry the fuel with you because there is no fuel to carry. You simply illuminate the spacecraft from afar, and then you shoot it out, more or less like an artillery piece or a gun, and it then glides at extremely high speed after being accelerated for only a couple of minutes, and then arrives at its target. In our case, the nearest targets are 4.5 light years is Alpha Centauri, and there are many other targets within a few tens of light years which are feasible. It arrives at the nearest targets in about 20 to 40 years. So we finally have a path forward. I think that's what's very different than, you know, the previous many generations of talks about interstellar flight, which always involved things which were not really feasible. We're trying to make it feasible.
You talk about a wafer. Of course, being from the Planetary Society, I like to think of it as a sail. But what are we actually talking about here? How big would these wafers be, these tiny spacecraft?
Spacecraft do not have to be wafers. We've focused in the NASA program on a very small spacecraft, because a second part of the program, in addition to producing these extraordinarily large laser arrays, which are the key to success in the whole program, whether a space-based or ground-based laser array, the key is to build large, not just high power, but large in aperture phased arrays. So that's key one. Key two is to produce spacecraft that are of low mass, because the lower the mass of the spacecraft, the faster it goes for a given power and size of array. So we focused on producing spacecraft at the wafer scale level, so literally things that are, you know, 10, 20, 30 centimeters in diameter and very thin, which, you know, sounds somewhat preposterous. People are used to thinking of the Voyager spacecraft or the Curiosity rover or, you know, any of the common spacecraft, which, you know, very heavy and have all kinds of sophisticated things on board that can be used for digging holes or taking pictures. But our spacecraft is, one of the designs of spacecraft is to simply fly by a target, take pictures, you know, measure radiation fields, measure magnetic fields, do spectroscopy on the target. And you can reduce all of that, including the laser communication system, the onboard power systems. You can reduce that to a wafer. And that's sort of the second thrust of this research.
Philip Lubin and Travis Brashears of Breakthrough Starshot and more. More excerpts from our long conversation when Planetary Radio returns in 1 minute.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan with another taste of my more than 1 hour conversation with UC Santa Barbara's Philip Lubin and his former intern, Travis Beshears. Philip has covered two legs of the work that is still barely underway toward their daunting goal of sending a tiny laser-driven probe to Alpha Centauri within a human lifetime.
And then the third one is the reflector. So in addition to the laser array and the spacecraft you're sending out, which can be a wafer size, but it could also be a CubeSat, just keep that in mind, or it could be a 100-kilogram Voyager-class spacecraft, or it could be a shuttle-class spacecraft, but larger mass is slower. So to realistically get to the stars with the kinds of system we're talking about, you want to keep it very small, preferably under 1 kilogram. The wafers actually are about 1 gram. The reflector, on the other hand, is not very large for the small spacecraft case. In the wafer scale case, the sail is of order a meter. So you're not talking about a very large, and you're certainly not talking about something that's very massive. It's very tiny. You could easily hold it in your hand. And that becomes a very different kind of mission to the, say, Project Daedalus or, Orion or, many of the projects that people talked about in the past for achieving high speeds both inside the solar system and out. It's totally different than what people normally think about in terms of solar sailing missions. In solar sailing missions, you want very large reflectors that are very low mass. So at least the low mass is similar, but you want very, very large reflectors. For laser-driven devices, spacecraft, you want very small sails. It's completely opposite, and it's not obvious until you go through the mathematics that you actually go faster by having smaller sails. The optimum point, which we show in our paper called A Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, is when the mass of the sail equals the mass of the bare spacecraft. That's when you achieve the maximum speed. So for a wafer-scale spacecraft, the sail is only on the order of a meter or so. It's like a human size. So it's very, very different than what you may be thinking of in terms of, say, a solar sail, the kind that you're working on at the Planetary Society. It's vastly different, and it's counterintuitive. People keep saying, make the sail bigger, make it bigger, make it bigger. And I keep telling them, no, if you make it bigger, go slower. it's counterintuitive.
We will put a link up, by the way, to that paper, A Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, along with some other terrific links on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. One of the links I'm going to put up there is to this terrific Time Magazine video interview that both of you appear in. Travis, you kind of get the last word in that video. You talk about what we opened with, sort of this increasing acceptance of the possibility of this that you've started to see.
Yeah, yes. It's definitely opened up a wide array of missions, as Phil was explaining. You really could go from just exploring our solar system or going interstellar, and that's really where we've gotten a lot of traction is the interstellar case. But there's a lot of missions along that roadmap that we'll also be able to do, and it opens up a lot of profoundly interesting means to explore the universe. That's what we hope to gain out of this. And what I mentioned in the Time video at the very end was, at first we started off with a lot of critics, which was very true. We would get, people would really like in conferences and talks, we'd kind of get funny looks like, they're proposing a kilometer class laser array, like these guys are a bit insane. But as we've gained a lot of traction through our NASA NIAC and now the Breakthrough Starshot program, it's become a lot more feasible and people have come to realize that this is the future and this is where we have to go.
Philip and Travis also talked about the Breakthrough Initiative and the portion of it called Breakthrough Starshot. Russian physicist, entrepreneur, and billionaire Yuri Milner has pledged $100 million to support their work. For more about that staggering effort, check out our episodes for August 4th and 11th last year. Or listen to my complete new conversation with Philip and Travis at planetary.org/radio.
He's just a really brilliant guy. I really love working with the team, as is Pete Warden. Pete Warden is delightful. He's so non-traditional, out-of-the-box kind of person, just a great, great guy to work with, as is the rest of the team. Anne is on that. Anne's on that.
Andrian, yeah.
Right. May Jemison, you know, a number of really just very bright and as well as a number of extremely technical people, you know, Freeman Dyson, people, you know, who've thought about these things in the past, and then a number of technologists in addition, Avi Loeb, very bright theoretical physicist, friend of mine from cosmology of over decades. So we have a really great team. It's a really exciting time. We just got our about a month after the breakthrough announcement, we received our NASA Phase 2 award. So we're now in the second phase of a NASA program. And NASA's been extraordinarily, I would say brave is the right word, because, you know, some things in NASA just have a kind of funny feel to them. And, you know, obviously SETI was one of them. And so they had to eventually get rid of that. Going interstellar always has this kind of weird, you know, vibe, I think, and at NASA, because it has to be credible. And they, in the reviews of our proposal in 2014, they eventually came back and said this was, you know, sort of the most futuristic, as I think they said, science fiction-y proposal that they had seen that was credible. And indeed, the credibility was the key point. So NASA's now gone on a limb, you know, and been unbelievably supportive of what we're doing.
I'm very grateful for this. And also for the truly amazing, awe-inspiring work that you have underway. And I look forward to following your progress as we head for the stars, quite literally. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Yeah,
thanks, Matt.
Time for What's Up with Bruce Betts on Planetary Radio. We are going to talk about the night sky, but eventually we're going to get to this absolutely fascinating trivia question. I complimented you for it when you posed the question. Now many listeners have, and we've had almost a record response, so I'm excited about getting to that.
Excellent. Well, in the evening sky over the next 2 or 3, 4 weeks, you can watch Mars and Antares, the red star in Scorpius, and Saturn moving relative to each other. They've been kind of just hanging out there, but now Mars will be moving between reddish Antares and yellowish Saturn over the next few weeks. And then Perseid meteor shower, traditionally the second best meteor shower of the year after the Geminids. It's got some good news, bad news. Bad news, there's moonlight in the evening. First of all, let me make sure I tell you, it peaks the night of August 11th and 12th, so the night beginning on the 11th. It is a broad peak, so you can be watching for Perseids from now to a week or two after the peak. There is moonlight in the early evening, but then after around midnight, depending on, you know, when you're looking, but around the peak, you actually, the sun will have set too, but the moon will set and you'll have dark skies. Also, some predictors are predicting an outburst, so a heavier than normal meteor rate. It's usually around 60 to 100 meteors from a dark sky. They say during the peak, during a few hours, there may be up to 200 meteors per hour, but it's always tough to predict such things. Point is, go out, relax, stare up at the sky, and watch for meteors as we come up on the 11th, 12th. We move on to this week in space history. In 2011, Juno was launched. I've heard something about Juno recently.
You're going to hear more later this month.
And in 2012, this week, Curiosity landed on Mars. Still going strong.
just doesn't seem like 4 years.
We move on to random spoofer.
I didn't quite catch that. No, go. That's okay. It's quite all right. Go ahead.
Comet Swift-Tuttle, the parent comet of the Perseid meteor shower, was noted in the sky by Chinese observers in both 69 BC and 188 AD.
Not bad.
All right, we move on to the trivia question that you enjoyed so very, very much. I asked you, if you landed at the same latitude and longitude on Earth as Apollo 11 landed on the moon, what country would you be in? How'd we do, Matt? I guess good.
Really, really good. As I said, a near record. Random.org picked out a first-time winner. It's Kendra Mullison from, get this, Poison, Montana. I love her answer. The landing site would be well within the boundaries of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, although I'm sure the Congolese would be surprised we didn't take a more affordable mode of transport. She got it right, right?
Yes, indeed.
Pretty much everybody figured out that it was going to be in the Congo. And I got some examples for you after I tell you that Kendra has won a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account on that worldwide network of telescopes, nonprofit network that you can use. Point them anywhere you like. Todd Yampol of Chandler, Arizona. He said, you'd be in dense jungle coming down at that spot in the Congo several days from the nearest town by moon buggy. A couple of people, Mike Clark and Wesley Haynes, both decided to tell us where we would be on Mars with the same coordinates, and apparently would be in Arabia Terra, northeast of Schiaparelli Crater, which just happens to be where Mark Watney had to get to on Mars to get to the Mars Ascent Vehicle and be rescued and make us all very happy, along with the studio that made the movie. All right, we're finally ready for next week's question, and I got a great prize.
I've got a straightforward question for a change. What spacecraft flew past Comet Borelli in 2001? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You've got until the 9th of August. Can you believe the year is flying by? Tuesday, August 9 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer to that new question from Bruce. And here's what you'll get. I ran into our friend Andy Weir, the author of The Martian. He kindly signed another copy of the book. It's sort of just open copied, but we're going to give that signed copy of The Martian, it's a paperback copy, to whoever wins this one. And we'll throw in a rubber asteroid as well, a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, and maybe an iTelescope.net account too, if you're nice.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about mold-colored molding. Thank you, and good night.
Is that how it got the name? I never thought of that. Thank you. You learned so much on this show.
I try to help.
He's Bruce Betts. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us each week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its farsighted members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed the theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.